marvelous.
How many minutes have you been? Best thing for me to do is
read it out. If we can become aware of our own temper,
we're not
this awareness to be that of a modification in a circumscribed zone of activity in which our action manages in feeling. The paper is shown to transcend any motion drawn on it, but our center will be a zone experiencing all the superior motions to the individual action band, as well as that which lies under all motions whatsoever, which is the simple in the first place. In experiencing centre as a possibility, would not the next strongest, weakest, superior motion arise in consciousness, and therefore is not such a move only one of many to be attempted? And the best thing to do with it is draw it. And before we do, we have a recurrent question about the planets and the symbolism of the days, which is always cropping up. Now, in most books on astrology, you will find three planets mentioned outside the limiting factor of Saturn. People want to know what Uranus and Pluto mean, because they are two of the three planets that are mentioned and for which no astrological significances are given if we go back a few hundred years. And of course, these planets are supposed to be fairly recent discoveries. Have they got any significance at all? And if so, why are they not reckoned in? Well, they are not reckoned in for any individual problem, because Saturn is itself the principle of individuation. And only those things inside the orbit of Saturn are individuated. And therefore, all the bodies outside the Saturnine limit are to be ignored for individual considerations. So if you link the names of the planets to the names of the days, then you'll be finding you've got a 7-day week instead of a 10-day week. The reason is simply that Saturn being the principle of individuation, whatever lies beyond the Saturnine band is not to be considered in relation to the individual. Uranus itself is the heavenly and therefore energy zone or plane of consideration. Pluto is the pylor principle, the formal principle within this. Both these two are non-individuated. Not until we come down to Saturn do we actually find we are dealing with centres of precipitation. The symbol of Saturn, as you know, symbolizes time over eternity, the formulated and fixed over the unformulated, unclosed. So that Saturn itself refers to the very principle of finite existence, and only the planets from Saturn included within, as you move towards the Sun, are to be considered in interpreting things for individuals. The three beyond Saturn should be interpreted as acting upon all beings equally and therefore of no value individually. They have a certain value to mystics insofar as mystics are trying to transcend their individual limitations, so that to be under the dominion of, say, Uranus is the same thing as to be heaven-orientated, to be trying to break this individuation factor of Saturn. But then again, everything is trying to break it in its own way. Like St. Paul says, the whole creation groans and travails to be delivered from vanity, which is the same thing as saying every man, every animal, every plant is trying to get rid of its limitations. Now we'll go back to this other question, which is really a related question. We take the paper to represent sentient power itself. It can move itself, it can feel itself. It can move in any way whatever. So if I draw a mark on the paper, it is to be considered that the paper itself is vibrating and making a circulation upon itself. This circulation it knows as its own circulation. It is an act of itself. when emotion starts to come in the spiral, it cannot go to a dead center. It can pack itself very tightly, but it must, by its nature, keep moving. And as more energy comes in and packs the action down, so it becomes more and more substantial, and yet it never goes inside to the center, because its essential nature is to keep moving. If it goes to the center, it stops dead. It cannot stop dead, therefore it cannot go to the center. So inside the center of every being, there is a zone of immanent spirit. This is initiative. This is yourself. This is isness. This is the verb to be for every individual. In the Negro mode of speaking, I is. This is initiative spirit. Now this question says, if we become aware of our own center, that is, of this immanent spirit, will not this awareness be that of the modifications of the circumscribed zone of activity to which our action band is inferior? Now here is the action band. It cannot go into the center of immanence, and therefore it is inferior to it. And when we go into center, we become aware of center with the modifications inside that center. That is to say, we discover that our immanent spirit, our initiative self, is a formulating power. And we become aware of the modifications that are inside there. Now, if we become a finite being, we generate contingent relation. Again, there's a sense of immanent spirit, untouched by the vibrations of the stimulus and contact. Any being travelling into center becomes aware of a creative force welling up on the inside and pressing out. But in the contingent stimulus, he is aware that he's being stimulated on his perimeter, on his skin surface, on his special sense organs, and so on, and that motion is moving inwards against the direction of the immanent spirit. So, if we remember that to move into center is to become conscious of the paper I'm drawn on, I shouldn't even write IS on it really. If we remember that, that we have a center of impulse operating, and it is the spirit itself vibrating in the center and discharging energies from that center to the perimeter. Now, the paper is underneath the action band as well, and the paper represents the power. Sentiency. So underneath the individuated action, there is still spirit. We call it immanent spirit in the central zone, transcendent spirit outside that zone, and we could call it underneath the action zone, the unconscious. In fact, this use of the word unconscious as underneath consciousness is more or less the significance given to it by Carl Jung. Freud would have a totally different idea of it. He would have the unconscious to be the not conscious from the point of view of the individual, but he would not have it a spiritual force, because Freud was really a materialist. But Jung is aware that really there is spirit underneath this action band, and that this spirit is somehow aware of the action wherever there is action, and simultaneously aware of the immanence in the empty zone in the center of the action, and aware of the transcendence beyond the perimeter. So the paper is underneath the action, means there is awareness underneath your action, even when you are identified with the action. That is, when you are identified, you can know that you are identified. In the case of a psychopath with an idée fixe, with just one idea in his mind, which he can't get rid of, he's actually forgotten that he is aware that he is fixed. He's simply fixed. That is, he's left over no zone of freedom in himself to consider that he is identified. So the man who thinks he is Napoleon and is identified completely with Napoleon is simply being Napoleon. He is not a man who is aware that he is believing he is Napoleon. He is, for himself, Napoleon. Now, Napoleon is just one concept inside his action man. There's his Napoleon concept. You might have got it from a film, from Moscow, maybe he's a retreater by nature, and trying to make retreat become significant, he identifies with a great retreating figure, and so turns his moral defeat into a military victory. Always at the back of an identification there is some intent to gain significance in the identification process. So a man who believes he's Napoleon has taken one little concept, it might be derived from a film or from reading the history of Napoleon, according to the cultural level, but whatever it is, it's derived from outside, and he has a series of ideas called his knowledge of Napoleon, and all the energy from his food that he ingests, he tends to pack into this center, so that the lines of least resistance from the digestive apparatus into the parts of the brain dealing with concepts all converge on the conceptual group called Napoleon. That means everything he eats goes in and feeds the Napoleon zone in himself. And this man, as we've defined him in the Idée Fixe, simply has a dominant concept with lines of least resistance from the digestive department to take up all the energy gained from broken down food and pack it into that concept. And he has none over to say, I am merely believing I am Napoleon. He said, I am Napoleon. Now for him, that's good enough. For other people outside, it may not be good enough for their purpose, and so they lock him up. The important thing is to see that his insanity, his not sameness, is his not wholeness. He has a little portion of himself, a concept, that pinches all the energy from the food and refuses to allow any statement to be made without first going through that Napoleonic concept. Now, if we could persuade that man to extend his definition of Napoleon, instead of trying to take his definition off him, we can help him. If we attack his statement that he is Napoleon, he defends himself, because he's a great military figure, he must. If you say he is not Napoleon, you're obviously jealous, and will have to be countered. So you cannot take away a fixed idea from a psychopath by simply proving it wrong, because he doesn't want to know it's wrong. He has adopted it because it is significant to him. And because you know there's a line of least resistance from the ear and the mouth and the stomach and everything else into the Napoleon concept, so you insert words in here which say, Napoleon is aware of the general implications of military strategy. He says yes. Napoleon is aware of the principles of geopolitics. He says yes. Napoleon is aware of the psychology of the masses. Yes. Napoleon is aware that every man, including Napoleon, has three parts, namely a head, a chest, and a belly. He says yes. Napoleon understands all men. Yes. Napoleon adjusts to facts. Yes. Now gradually you're getting him to open himself to the idea that even if he is Napoleon, he can afford to adjust. And if he's on St. Helena, or in another place near St. Helens, not far away, then he might realize that he could get out of that strange place, providing he learned to adjust, like a true Napoleon, to the necessities of the situation. He can escape from there by adjusting himself. So we're packing more concepts into the Napoleonic concept, and gradually Napoleon is spreading through the action man to include more and more concepts, until finally he discovers, really, that he is all men. And finally, by inversion, all men are the same as himself. And then he may become fit to talk to. The important point to see is that, progressively, a person with a fixed idea can be made aware of the fact that the idea is not the whole of themselves, by putting in implications on the idea, and thus forcing the concept to grow bigger and bigger, until gradually we lead them to realize that any form as such, necessarily being circumscribed, is finite and locked. And the fact of it being locked, it is made impotent. If you say impotent, it's the same as impotent. And the po means power, and the tent means home. So N before P, which is a labial, becomes M. So impotent means impotent, in power holding, holding the power in. Now, every time there is a finite zone of that order, you are limited. So that the fact that you can see the binding limit proves that your consciousness is bigger than the limiting factor. You are aware of a line means that you transcend a line. Imagine for a moment that we make a dot. Supposing you identify with the dot completely, so that you become dotty, absolutely, you do not know the paper exists. And therefore, for you, there is no edge to your dotness. Because the edge can only come into consciousness with the awareness that the dot is finished and the paper is starting. So to identify with the dot totally is to cease to know anything whatever. To become any single form, a complete unified consciousness with one form only, is to cease to be aware of even that form. So we find in a catatonic of long standing that he's not even aware that he's a vegetable anymore. Since he has no process, he just sits, you open his mouth, shovel in the food, and the food just vegetates inside him and then digests itself and maintains his physical structure, but nothing else happens. He doesn't even know that he's a dot. He is being a dot, not thinking he is a dot. Thinking one is a dot is separate from being a dot. As soon as we become aware, therefore, that there is a limiting factor to the dot, it is finite, it is a proof that we have become aware of the space around it. And the space transcends the finiting factor of the dot. Space is simply the untouched paper here. And so this paper represents spirit, and that dot represents any body whatever, any limiting factor. Now, the paper is sentient power itself. In the center, it is simply aware that it is sentient power, and that sentient power of itself, of its own nature, is creative. It is continuously bubbling up from infinity, creating new situations and new forms from center. Outside it is transcendent, and there it is absolutely free. Between the transcendent and the immanent, there is action going on, but the action itself is simply the modal operation of spirit in the place of the action level. So we really have spirit three times. Immanent spirit, which is freely creative, action-bound spirit, which is bound to do something. Like when a man says, I am bound to go to the pictures tonight with my wife or girlfriend, I am bound, he's referring to this thing, a determination, and then the mystical experience, the transcendent spirit, which goes beyond the action band and away from the immanent spirit. Now in Buddhistic training you move towards transcendent spirit, specifically. In Christian training you move towards immanent spirit. Christ says the kingdom of heaven is within. You go inside the action man because it is nearer than going outside. Because the mental life of people generally is fairly involved in memory processes rather than in the immediate sensation. So the general tension of a person, the intention, the pressing in, the holding in, is nearer to immanent spirit than it is to an experience of transcendent spirit. And if you move to the perimeter of your being, you're moving towards the zone where you could have a contingent stimulus distracting you. If you were in a pure void, like a man training for space travel, then you could experience something what it's like to become aware of transcendent spirit with the action man within it. You know the device where they put a man in a special plastic suit and they put him in a fluid and they balance it so carefully that he becomes weightless. And they make it so that he gets no incoming messages through the ears or eyes or to the sense of smell and so on. And then you have a being that is apparently weightless and has no sense data from five senses. And therefore his content of consciousness is simply the activity going on inside the substance of his body. They remove the continued stimulus of other bodies as far as possible. And the result experimentally is that this man training for space flight discovers himself invaded by fantasy. He has no reference point at first. His mind starts discharging its energies because there's no external stimulus to focus it. There's nothing external to focus on. Therefore, all the inner form in the action man begins to intensify its activities and it breaks out in a mild attack of schizophrenia. Now, if the man is warned beforehand that this will happen, and it is explained to him why it will happen, then he can have a bit of confidence when it does happen. But in order to do this, we have to separate part of the man off and saying this is your true self, for the time being, a conceptual reference point. You notice that the seven men chosen for space travel in America are all religious men. They are men who have an idea that there is a self inside us that can be referred to quite independently of any external situation. And this inner self is spirit. So men who believe that spirit exists and that the soul exists have an idea inside themselves of soul or self, spiritual, and they can refer to this idea in the midst of their fantasy. So that in the midst of the outbreaking of every fantastic thing that's ever been engrammed on their substance, they can, by concentrated effort, hold on to the idea, I am a soul, and this around me is fantasy. Now it isn't quite the same thing as penetrating into immanent spirit, but it is a step towards it. That would be called in yoga the modification of control, namely a concept that I can gain control. That concept, I can gain control, isn't the same thing as gaining control, but it is a necessary step to it. We set up the concept inside, I am a self, and that all outside this self that happens, all formal play, all phenomena, in a certain sense is fantastic, and it can be ignored because I have a reference point. If I can now carry my reference point inwards and break through this band, I will find myself in immanent spirit. If I do that, I might not bother to go after all on the space trip. And then, of course, training a man for space flight, you don't encourage him too much about the immanent spirit, because he won't do as he's told when he's found it. It's much better to train him that he has a centre of reference. In practice, you can find, if you stand on a rotating platform like our homemade dervish which we use, and you rotate rapidly and then put the brake on and stop, so the fluids inside your middle ear department and in the labyrinth spin round, and you get a sense of rotation which causes dizziness. You open your eyes and you see all the walls rolling about around you. If you have no reference point, you become sick. If you have a very well established reference point in you, you can just say, this is the product of the swirling of fluid inside a certain little organ in the middle of my head. And I'm going to ignore it because the data are false. The walls are not really going up and down and twisting and bending. It's the product of stimulation inside a special little apparatus with hairs in it and so on, and fluid whizzing around, sending false messages. If I know this to be true, I can stabilize myself, even surrounded by fantasy. Now, the paper is shown to transcend any motion drawn on it, but our centre would be a zone experiencing all superior motions to the individual action man, as well as that which lies under all motions whatever. Lying under all motions whatever is sentient power. The sentient power is itself the supreme experiencer. The sentient power is the infinite observer of all beings whatever. But an observer is simply an observed. The word ob will be, and with an R in the middle for orb, simply means a sphere. So there is an ob, and to serve it is to attend with your sentient power to that ob. When anything whatever is thrown into consciousness for such serving, we call it an object. Object means throw. So an object in consciousness is a sphere of power specially precipitated in order to serve it. Now this object itself is not the paper, but it is the paper modifying itself spherically. So somehow the object is the subject. You find in Indian philosophy, in the Bhagavad Gita and so on, the slayer, the slain, and the slain are the same. That paper is vibrating and producing an ob. But the ob that is produced is not the paper, it is a motion of the paper. The sea is not the waves, but the waves are the motion of the sea. So this ocean of paper, this ocean of papyrus, or Father who creates by positing vibrations, he's positing zones of activity which are called off, he's throwing them inside himself and then attending to them. And when such a sphere exists and is attended to, the amount of sentient power attending to it is called the server of the arm or the observer. But the observer is not the observed. And you don't have to serve any arm unless you will to. And if there is an arm in existence, that arm is a precipitative will. This means that every tiniest particle, the tiniest electron, is really a centre of will to exist. There's a will to exist in the atom, a will to exist in a plant, an animal, a man, and so on. Wherever there's a little orb, there is a will pressing in to keep it in being. That will is the sentient power itself, contracting, opposing itself, compacting, and so reducing its area, and so intensifying the zone. It's packing power, sentiency, into the place. It is simultaneously making the place dense in terms of power and raising its sentiency. If you contract a muscle, you become more aware of it than you do when it's relaxed. If you relax your hand, you're not so very aware of its shape. If you contract it and grip it as a fist, you become aware of it. If you point a finger rigidly, you become aware of it. If you let it relax, you do not. To contract is to contract, to act against one's own being. If I close my fist and grip with my fingers into my palm and then grip my fingers with my thumb, I'm acting upon myself. This is contraction, contraction. This contraction is the guarantee that I become sharper. So if I can have a verbal argument with myself in which I contradict myself all the time, I will become more and more aware of the subject matter than if I agree with myself all the time. Hence opposition is true friendship. In experiencing centre, would not the next strongest superior motion arise in consciousness? Now we've just answered this by saying, nothing arises in consciousness except that which is will. We have to cover our paper again with centres, because this paper represents the power of Sri Delhi and the pillar or point of differentiation. Papyra, which is the papyrus of the Egyptians, like the motherlands. That's your father, and this is his reason for being. We cover the paper with circles to represent perimeters with centers which originate those perimeters. One center sends out a certain amount of energy, other centers contradict it, and between the two centers arises the circumference. Now you can see what Blake meant when he said that reason is simply the outer limit of will. This is very, very important. Reason is simply the outer limit of will. Let's draw being in infinity again. He posits a power and it starts to expand to infinity. Now, if there are no other points to resist it, it simply goes on extending itself infinitely, and at the same time it is not knowing itself reflexively. It is just propagating infinitely and making nothing whatever. The energy of infinity is welling up and going out, and nothing is happening to it because there is no opposition. So it sets up another centre which does exactly the same thing. And the two centres motions come upon each other and press, and they create there a limiting factor, the firmament. Remember that word firmament used in the Bible in the original means a thing hammered out from both sides. Now it is here on this perimeter which is generated by two will centers acting upon each other. Here upon this perimeter is what you call reason. And reason always explains why you didn't get any further. The reason inside you is simply saying, what happened that I didn't get any further than I got? And the reason is that there was another centre that stopped you. So the reason is really a kind of excuse mechanism for why we didn't manage to knock the other fellow down. Blake saw that perfectly well, and said that the reason, that is this perimeter, is simply the outer limit of the will. So you have so much energy, you push out so far, and you are surrounded by other centers like the bulls of Bashan, and they are knocking you in again. As far as you can get before the resistance is too great for you to push further is your zone of will. But where you can push no further, the translating energy from the center then becomes the rotating energy, rotated by the outside forces, and is stopping its expansion. And as soon as it rotates, it's a Torah motion, a ratio motion. You are now rationalizing. The rationalizing is simply the automatic product of a resistance to your will. This means every time you find yourself making excuses for yourself, it really means you've come to the limit of your willpower in the situation. Is experiencing center, in experiencing the center as a possibility, would not the next strongest superior motion arise in consciousness? Nothing will arise in consciousness unless we will it. And we will it by being interested in it, because on some previous occasion, either we have succeeded in it and want to do it again, or we have failed in it and think we might be able to solve it next time because we feel a little stronger, or we have failed in it and believe we're going to fail in it again. So we have these possibilities. But the thing that will make us decide to do A, B, C, if we are not careful, is the dictatorship of memory. That is, our previous successes or failures will impose upon us. But if we know that this memory is in the action band, and that the action band of itself is simply a record of previous limits, because remember there can be no rotation unless there are two forces in opposition, one from inside and one from out. So everything in the action band here has its rational form and is really an explanation of why failure occurred on a previous occasion. So if you really want to be creative, you ignore the action band and you go to your center and spring out again. And you're determined to make the immanent and the transcendent identical, so you are reducing the attention, the amount of will tension in the action band of your mind. The mind itself as a rational structure is turbulating continuously and formulating excuses for deficiency of will. There's a question about analysis of prefixes and suffixes there. The best thing to do with those, in any decent dictionary, certainly in a school dictionary, you'll find at the back of it a list of prefixes and suffixes, and those you should actually commit to memory, so that every time you see a word with them, you immediately take the prefix off and abstract the root and consider the meaning of the root separately before you put the prefix or suffix on it. A slight warning we might make about the prefix pre, and that pre means before in a dictionary, fixing before as in pre-vision. But really the P and the R mean a point and the vibration of that point, differentiating round it. So you cannot pre-see, you cannot have pre-vision unless you are able to see the forces acting and differentiating in that place. So pre also means the reason process of previous power formulations, which you examine to see if you can discover the law of power. And there's a word in Sanskrit used in yoga and Buddhist theory quite a lot, and that is prajna. That's really two words. Jna is K-N of W. This is knowledge. Jna is the same as kno. And pra here is the same root as pre in the prefix, but its real meaning is still there. P is the point posited, and R is the vibration of that point, distributing itself through space, and R is the energy, the triangle. Represents the energy, the fire symbol. So, para means the positive energy the differentiations produced by that, going to the term of energy absorption. And then the knowing of that fact is prajna. Now, in prajna is said to be the great secret of everything. And this is not just nonsense, it's a plain statement of fact. If we can discover exactly what happens to one billiard ball when we hit it, we can begin to reason what will happen if we throw one billiard ball at three. The weight of one striking against will knock one off the end. If we throw two, we'll knock two off the end. And so on. If there are complex groupings of billiard balls, when we shoot a ball at them at a certain angle, we will disperse those balls in the group in a definite geometrical manner. Anybody who plays snooker knows this. Now, it may be thought that a human being is different from a snooker game, but in principle he is not, as to his vehicle. His vehicle is made up of little power packets, much smaller than an atom, but still spheres, still little balls, and still subject to reaction to stimuli. This means that geometrical propagation of forces is the key to the understanding of even the complex being like a human being. And prajna means precisely this, to understand how a positive point will react in a given energy situation. To know that fact is prajna. So if you consider your own actions all the time in terms of yourself as a complex formal structure being hit by a billiard cue, by a stimulus, see in what direction you tend to fly when a stimulus of a certain order hits you. To become aware of that is to become aware of the meaning of prajna. Now, have we any specific points to raise?
Going back to that question, you have drawn before on other occasions a series of circles, each one being internal to another. Each band has sub-rotations, and within the sub-rotations it shows up. Each of those sub-rotations has a centre, which from that diagram would appear to be imposed on the action band of that circle which contains it.
Yes.
So, from this, is it not true that if you go into that centre, what you become aware of is the action band of that centre which contains it?
Well, let's have a look. Here is one big circle. It's traversed by others like this, all the way round. And this generates another circle inside it. And this is traversed in the same way, so that we get other circles inside here, and the same inside here, until we come down to the tiniest ones we can draw. In terms of vibrations, we come down to the tiniest vibration we can get without that vibration impinging on the next vibration to the point of destroying it utterly. So there is a limiting factor. There is a smallest vibration. There is a smallest circle. Yet inside each one of those, there's an immanent spirit. Because itself is an action band. So no matter how tiny we may go, even down to the size of the electron, inside it there is immanent spirit that is undrawn on paper, and therefore there is spiritual intelligence inside. And that itself is coming out and trying to create from centre. But it is always trying to create over against the contingent relationship with the other centres. You can see that if you take this large circle to represent a human being, and then we put three circles inside it to represent thinking, feeling and urging. Already we have a continued stimulus situation between the urge and the feeling, and the feeling and the thinking, and the thinking and the urge. So the urge can impinge from outside on your thinking process. Feeling can impinge from outside on your urge or your thinking. And yet inside each one of those three, there's immanent spirit pressing out. In the one case, immanent spirit is creating thought. In the other, it is creating feeling. In the other, it is creating urge. Pure power coming out. So already you have three large sevens. Thinking itself is a kind of seven. Feeling is a big seven. Urge is a big seven. And then inside the thinking process again, you have other entities. The same will put it simply here, three. You can think about thinking, you can think about feeling, you can think about energy. And those are sevens within the thinking order. And then inside, it's the same. You can will to will, you can will to feel, you can will to think. You can feel about feeling, feel about thinking, or feel about energy. So already you have nine classes of sevens there. When you come to remember that contingent stimuli from outside can stress a specific form, which is an idea, and put upon it a particular load of feeling, there's some liaison between feeling heart centre and this little local zone, an idea created from outside in education, and a certain amount of urge energy goes into it, usually to resist the education. And therefore you have a little sevent there with a threefold nature of its own. You see, the problem of sevent is really the problem of other entities with inside a big one. You can identify at any level. A half an hour ago, when we were working together, we just re-stimulated a little tiny zone in a person, a very tiny zone, and yet as soon as that zone was opened, the whole being was invaded with a smell of ether, with an incapacity to lift up the arms, and with fear. It was locked up in that little zone. When it came out, it so frightened the whole organism, frightened simply and vibrated more than it could assimilate, that automatically it opened its eyes to escape the stress, and then had to re-enter into it consciously to disperse it. Each one of the experiences we've had in a contingent relation is turbulated by the fact of its mode of entry. A stimulus comes into a being, and the being reacts to the stimulus. Between the entering stimulus and the reaction, there is a zone of turbulation. This turbulation is the same thing as the generation of an idea with an affective tone and a power packet involved in it. You must not divide the substance, you must not confound the persons. Therefore, you are dealing with sentient power formulating. That's a threefold being in itself. And every single stimulus you've ever had, your substance has reacted to it, and the two, according to the balance of power, have caused a zone of rotation, turbulence, and the fact that it is a zone closed means it is formed, or is therefore an idea. The fact that it is power means it's a definite urge value, and the fact that the urge and the idea are simultaneously experienced gives it the pleasure pain value at the affective level. So every single sevent inside us has these three aspects. And sevents are created continuously wherever there is stimulation and response.
Has a sevent a centre?
The sevent has an imminent centre of creative spirit and is fighting for its life. And the only thing you can do with it to convert it is to do what we will do on that Napoleon figure. Educate it into a wider concept. If you take any one of your antipathies, which is a sevent, and you simply tell it, oh, you're being antipathetic, which is wrong, it will tell you calmly to go to hell. It might borrow your grandmother's voice to say it, but it will say it. You cannot invalidate anything whatever. Somehow you've got to validate the whole structure and then let everything go into its own place. There's a place even for naughtiness, like playing Ludo or something without permission. Everything has a time and a place and a possible function which must be honoured. If you don't honour it, well, it will kick, because it is a real entity. The attempt to destroy silence by lecturing them from outside made one great thinker say nothing historically has ever been accomplished by exhortation. We've had thousands of years of priests and others exhorting people to behave themselves. All we've got in exchange is juvenile delinquency. Why? Because exhortation isn't so good as inhortation. The external stimulus hitting any being must produce a reaction by law. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you stimulate a being with a command, the counter command comes from the being, and a zone of turbulence develops, and that thing is now a sevent, and it will defend itself. If you can't show it how to assimilate with other beings to its own benefit, it won't listen to you. So if you have what you call a bad habit, and you say it's a bad habit and you've got to stop it, it just goes on doing it. You've got to find a place for that habit, where that habit is useful. And then it will play with you. It will do as you say, because you are doing what it says. And there's no other way of converting it.
You can't set it to go into its own centre.
Oh yes, you can. But that's its own centre. That it won't mind. Give it a sense of property.
What is it aware of in its own centre? Is it not aware of one's total mnemic content and not of immanent spirit? Only immanent spirit as it modifies itself as one's mnemic content.
In order to become aware of oneself, one must reflect. You have a centre sending out energies. Those energies are sentient powers. It must hit against something and then return to centre. If that doesn't happen, there can be no reflection, there can be no awareness that one is doing anything whatever. One can do without reflection, and then one doesn't know that one is doing. But if one can find a mode of reflection, so that the energies one liberates are forced back, then we know what we've sent out. We make allowance for the kind of mirror we've hit, and then we can calculate the kind of force we let out by what happens to us on its return. This is reflective activity. Now, here is a sub-end with its immanent spirit. Its immanent spirit is creative, so it just posits its own activity. But it's in a contingent relationship with other sub-ends. So those sub-ends are pressing upon it, and the two actions from inside and out generate a zone of turbulence between, and this is called the action band. Now, the being in the place of this action band is aware of the action and the turbulation which arises from its own immanent spirit and the contingent relation. But it has the power to stress either the turbulence or its own immanence. The general tendency is to stress the turbulence because the force from inside is tending to go out. So because it's creative, we tend to be extroverted. It's only the external situation stimulus hitting us that introverts us. So the great ascetic mystics, first of all, go out and enjoy themselves to the best of their ability, and then they get stuck by some colossal, to them, cataclysm, and this knocks them into the desert where they then meditate. They don't just get out of the cradle and say to Mama, I think I'll retire and sit me on a column in the desert. First of all, they've got to be hit and made aware that there are other beings before they retired into the desert. So in the same way, heathen, incidentally, can be translated to either garden or desert. You don't become introverted unless the contingent stimulus situation is so tough that you cannot feel yourself with enough power to push it back. You're really trying to grow. Your immanent spirit is pushing out. And then so are the immanent spirits of other beings. And between the clash of these two imminences arises the band of turbulence. And when you look into the turbulence, you want to defend yourself, meaning your turbulence records. But if you withdraw from your turbulence, not simply from a contingent negating knock, but positively because you know there's an imminent centre of spirit, initiative in yourself, if you withdraw into that, you become aware of data conferred upon you by the absolute, that is, by the paper itself. And this gives you data about the other fellow's intention, which he has in his immanent spirit. So you're one up on him. You can then adjust. You might even move away when he's knocking. Then he thinks he's got nobody to knock against. So he chases you and says, please stand still, I want to hit you. Because I want to know what I'm like as a hitter. I don't know whether anyone saw that very good little film called Sitting the other day, the American problem. A white boy who joined in with the Negroes and was beaten suddenly showed as an external stimulus factor himself to the Negroes that somehow they should be beaten too, that they would never know they were non-violent unless they were beaten and were able to accept the beating. Now, because of this lad being beaten, they were able to respond to the stimulus and to submit themselves to being beaten to see what it meant. In the process, they were being hammered Until they're hitting back, they were accepting it and absorbing it. The hammers were wondering what to do next. Meanwhile, the energy of the stimulus was going in and differentiating inside their minds, and this differentiation gave them a new idea. They were saying, we accept the beating as if we had no power. And the force of the stimulus from outside vibrated their substance and raised an idea, but we have some power, namely economic power. We have $60 million a year to spend. Supposing we just don't spend it with the big white chief. Supposing we don't go in his shops, what will he do? Supposing we do go to the shops and say, look, we have buying power. Buying power is the same as voting power. You can insult me that I happen to have $60 million that you want. Are you going to insult me? And suddenly they found they had economic power, which they had not previously realized. One of the fellows interviewed said, up to that time I had believed, and my wife had believed, that she had to have a new coat. And suddenly we discovered she didn't have to have a new coat. Maybe she would not have a new coat on purpose. Maybe she would not have one in order to annoy the salesman. There was one very pathetic bit where white salesmen were attending to Negro buyers of TV sets and so on, as if the Negro buyers were gentlemen, because they had dollars. Now they could never have discovered that buying power in themselves, that economic pressure, if they had not first of all submitted to the attack from outside. Because the energy of the stimulus applied from outside, not being reacted to, ran about inside their substance, stimulated the whole of their content, and raised their general level of awareness to the point where they suddenly knew something that they didn't know before. Now this is really the meaning of Christianity. If you dare to allow somebody to bang a nail in, instead of trying to dodge it, it simply means that the energy of the stimulus given you will give you a new idea. And you can't get it any other way. You've got to find an inflection point for your will. You can only find it in other existing finite beings. This is why, if you can't get a group of people to work together, you cannot accelerate the development. Because you've got to be able to shoot that stimulus to somebody, it has to hit and it has to come back. Only if it does can you develop. It's for that reason and for no other. But if you try to keep what you've got to yourself so that it never hits against anything, you will generate fantasy rather than fact. The existence of other beings is a necessity for the evolution of any single one. Every single cement has an imminent center creatively pressing out. It is stopped by the imminent center forces of others, and between them they create a perimeter. Between them they create zones of turbulence. If they identify with the turbulence, they're in trouble. If they keep on identifying with the immanent spirit, they can become aware of the state of the other immanent spirit of other beings. And they can then adjust to the intention instead of the fact. The inner intention of a person is quite transparent to you, regardless of what their turbulating zones and speech organs say about it. Remember, the reason somebody gives us about an act is a fabrication out of his impotence. He doesn't give you a reason if he can perform. He gives you a reason if he can't. If he fears that he can't, he will say something to explain why he should be allowed to do so-and-so. If he has the power to do it, he doesn't tell you. He just does it. So, obviously, to grow in immanence, to grow in power, to grow in awareness of initiative is the same thing as to move out of the turbulence band, inwards, to move away from the contingent stimulus reaction, and therefore not to defend any concept one has. It's a very good exercise for 1 week. We can all do this and we'll all write an essay about it. For the coming week, put inside your mind a simple sentence: if anybody attacks any of my ideas at all, I will not defend them. That's that. It will teach you a very strange lesson about your inner constitution. Engrave that in the mind: if somebody attacks my idea, I will not defend it.
dictionaries and see if we can find somebody who will attack.
I think you've had a problem, you'll find a type. Because if you don't, it means you manage to keep your mouth closed for a week. It's a lot about. Now,